a story. I'm gonna tell you about my town. I'm gonna tell you a big fat story, baby. It's all about my town. Yeah, down by the river, down by the banks of the River Charles. That's what's happening, baby.
I'm talking with author Don Stradley, whose new book is Slaughter in the Streets: When Boston Became Boxing's Murder Capital, and that's from Hamilcar Publications. Before we get into the book, will you talk about your background in writing about boxing, how you got into that?
Yeah, sure. I've been writing about boxing for most of the major publications, including The Ring magazine, ESPN.com, quite a few others, British magazines. I even wrote for a magazine out of South Africa. I've been writing about boxing for maybe 14 years. And I also had an interest in true crime. If you live in the Boston area, you get a lot of true crime. And it seemed that it was a natural way to write a story that would blend my boxing interest with my interest in true crime, because I kept finding that they would bump up against each other, those two topics, particularly in Boston.
How did you get started on this specific book?
Well, Hamilcar Publications had hired me to write another book, and when I finished with that one, we thought, well, what should our next subject be? You know, because I wanted to do another one. And over drinks one night, my publisher and I started talking about all of these boxers in Boston who had been killed because of their links to organized crime. And at first I was just going to do it as a short piece, but the more we talked about it, the more we realized there's a whole book there. There's a lot of history there. And the more I researched it, the more I realized it went back much further than I initially thought. My original idea was that it began sort of in the 50s and 60s and then peaked. But as I researched it, I found out that it went back more than 100 years. And eventually we decided, let's do it, some blood and guts, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. You know, it's always kind of been a favorite subject of mine, the mafia and boxing. So this book just felt like a natural, and it almost wrote itself. It was sort of a labor of love for me, but I was also surprised at how easily it kind of wrote itself.
So how is Boston unique in regard to the story? Like, what is it about that city that made it a breeding ground for fighters and crime and kind of the intersection of the two?
Well, to my best knowledge, the size of the city is really what caused all of this to happen. It's a very small city, particularly the neighborhoods that I focus on in the book, the North End, and also an area that's called South Boston, which is where Whitey Bulger came from. And I'm sure you're familiar with Whitey Bulger. He was such a big name in the, in the criminal genre.
Yeah.
These were small neighborhoods. And during the 1930s and 40s and 50s, they were very poor neighborhoods. And the two main ethnic groups, the Irish and the Italians, were still facing not just economic hardships, but also a lot of racial discrimination. People forget that the Italians and the Irish were very discriminated against back at that time. So it was almost, and I'm speaking in a very broad term here, it was almost a given that if you were a young man in the North End or in South Boston or in nearby Charlestown, if you were a young man at that time period, you would turn to crime or you would turn to boxing. Mm-hmm. Boxing is well known for attracting poor kids who saw no other way to make money, so they would kind of venture into boxing, hoping that they could make a few bucks in the ring. Believe it or not, that was sort of it was a valid thing back in that time. Now you tell people, oh, you got to be crazy. You're going to fight for a living. But back then, it was not so out of the question that a young man would take up boxing thinking he was going to make some money. Meanwhile, all of his pals were probably turning to a life of crime. It was a very widespread phenomenon. Kids in the North End and in the South, South Boston, were turning to crime. It was a very widespread phenomenon. And they dovetailed. Kids who were boxing knew kids who were criminals. And when a guy's boxing career was coming to an end, because a lot of them were short-lived, he'd find that, hey, my pals are doing pretty well in the mob or robbing or stealing. My friends are doing pretty well, so maybe I'll just join up with them for a while and see how that works out. After boxing, a life of crime was not that big of a jump. And also a lot of them were criminals before they went into boxing. So they went from crime to boxing back to crime. Mm-hmm. So it all dovetailed, and it just got deeper and deeper from the 40s, when boxing was huge, into the 50s and 60s, when a lot of my story takes place.
Mm-hmm. I always ask writers about the research process after they've written a book. What can you talk about the research? Were you able to track down a lot of people from the old days who told you stories, or was it a lot of time in the, going through microfilm, or how did you go about kind of putting the whole thing together?
Well, it came to me in fits and starts for years before I actually sat down to write it. As you know, there have been a lot of books about Boston's mob activity, particularly through the Whitey Bulger years and the Irish gangs. And because I was interested in that subject, I used to read all of these books about Whitey Bulger and Joe Barboza and a lot of these rather nasty criminal characters. And as I was reading those books, just for amusement, I kept noticing that boxers were involved, usually minor boxers, and occasionally they were getting killed. And when I found out, I did a personal count. I just started counting, and when I got up to about 25 boxers, I thought it was almost like a widespread epidemic of boxers being murdered in the streets of Boston, and I thought it was fascinating. So when I sat down to write the book, I decided I'm going to find out about those boxers who were murdered, and I'll tell their stories. Because everybody knows the Whitey Bulger story. Not everybody knows the story of these various boxers. So what I did was I divided the book into 15 or 17 chapters, and I picked 15 or 16 fighters, gave each one of them a chapter, sort of chronicling his rise and his fall. Because to me, it was bittersweet. I did find a few people who were around in boxing, four guys in particular. They were boxing in the Boston area at that time, and they knew about the influx of criminals into boxing and of boxing into the crime world. They knew about it. They hadn't necessarily been personally touched, but they knew a lot of the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And they were able to share some of their stories and give the book a little bit of a personal touch. So it was a mix of research that I had already done years ago just for my own amusement, and talking to these four gentlemen. Their names were Eddie Spence, Eddie Greinke, Jimmy Connors, and... remember the fourth one, a guy named Jerry Forte. Those four gentlemen, they're older men now. They're in their 70s and 80s, I believe. And they, the memories were still good, and they were able to share a lot of what they saw and what they knew. They were able to describe what the city was like in those days, what boxing was like in those days, and how there was occasionally a seedy criminal element that would wander into the gyms, almost like vampires trying to find these young boxers that they could manipulate. It seemed that even Whitey Bulger liked having boxers around. It was kind of like hiring foot soldiers. Whitey had a bunch of them.
This is kind of a two-part question. You talk about the Boston Gang War of the 1960s in the book, and a lot of people, I've always found that a really fascinating story. A lot of people don't know even really what that is. Could you talk a little bit about that? And you also talk about a fighter who was wrapped up in that and was a big part of it, who was killed, and his name was Punchy McLaughlin. Will you just talk about that kind of story a little bit?
Oh, yeah. The Boston Irish Gang War, or sometimes it was called the McLean-McLaughlin War, that was a fascinating period of time, went throughout all the 1960s. And it was basically just a bunch of guys who had gotten in each other's face at a party one night. One guy, Punchy McLaughlin's younger brother, made a pass at a woman, and it turned out she was with members of a rival Irish gang. And before you know it, there were car bombs, daylight shootings, decapitations. It was a huge mess that went out all during the 60s in broad daylight. I can't even begin to count the number of bodies that piled up in that period. But the surprising thing to me, as I said earlier, was a lot of them had done some boxing in their time. So to me, that was fascinating that they drifted easily from boxing into crime. Punchy McLaughlin was a boxer, and Buddy McLean had been an amateur boxer, and they all kind of knew each other from boxing before they had become such major criminals out on the Boston waterfront.
T.J. English wrote the foreword for the book, and he talks about how this kind of world, this Boston, doesn't really exist anymore. Can you talk about that a little bit, and also how you got hooked up with T.J. English?
Well, my publishers approached T.J. English. They thought that because he had a background in writing about the Irish gangs. In fact, T.J. English probably opened the door for everybody, because he wrote a book called Paddy Whacked. And that book was a big seller, and it meant a lot to a lot of people and developed quite a cult following. Boston loves its criminals, that's for sure. So he had a built-in audience. So my publishers approached him and asked him if he would write the foreword to the book. And fortunately, he asked to read the book before he wrote his foreword, and he liked the book, so I was happy to hear that. And he agreed to write a little something to start the book out. So I was very happy with that, because I always liked him as a writer, and I'm proud to have him as the author of the foreword. As for Boston changing over the years, it certainly has. I personally don't even consider Boston a city anymore. I consider it sort of a big shopping area. It no longer has the personality that it had when I first lived in Boston 30 years ago. When I moved to Boston in the 80s, it was a city with all the good and bad that a city can bring you. Now it's no longer a city because it is neither good nor bad. It's just sort of a crowded shopping area. There are sports teams, and tourists come in to watch the sports teams, but it's no longer a city. I don't know where you would go nearby to find that kind of city activity. But when I was a kid, Boston had gangs and criminals and alongside movie theaters and great restaurants. You had the light side and the dark side. Mm-hmm. Now the dark side has kind of been chased away into other areas, other parts of Massachusetts. And whatever light side is left is pretty much just overpriced and not that interesting. Now, younger people who are moving into the city now, maybe they think it's great. Maybe they love it. I don't know. But it's definitely not the same city that I lived in for a while. And it's definitely not the same city that I wrote about in Slaughter in the Streets.
Right. What can you tell people a little bit about what the combat zone in Boston was? That was way before. I've never even seen that. But I've read a lot about it and seen a lot of pictures about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the combat zone in Boston was, it was an area designated for adult entertainment, strip joints, erotic dancing. You know, you could go there to buy anything from an inflatable love doll to dirty magazines. You could see strippers. You could pick up prostitutes. It was a crazy, colorful type of area that was actually sort of set aside by the city. The governor thought it was a great idea if we could just take all of the smut and pornography and limit it to one little area. And it was kind of behind where Chinatown was. So it at one point, businessmen on their lunch hour could go into Chinatown, get a quick lunch, grab a drink, go into this combat zone area, watch a stripper do her act, and I guess they don't call them strippers anymore, do they? What do they call them? Exotic dancers? I don't know.
Yeah.
but a businessman could go from State Street, which is just a few blocks away, go into Chinatown, have lunch, go have a drink in the combat zone, watch a dancer, maybe even hook up with a prostitute, and then, you know, be back at his desk after an hour or an hour and a half. And it was not considered strange. My father used to tell me these stories because he worked in Boston. And you know, it was kind of taken for granted that, you know, men on their lunch hour would go into the zone and have some fun. But then gradually drugs became the bigger selling item in the zone. And then during the crack era of the 80s and 90s, the combat zone gave way to not just sex and pornography, but also drugs. It became a very dangerous drug area. And that kind of destroyed, you know, a lot of the funny aspect of the zone. You know, middle-aged businessmen didn't want to go in there now with crack dealers and, you know, drug addicts kind of stabbing each other in the streets, which is what was going on at that point. And gradually, a lot of the businesses started moving out to different parts of the city, or actually out along Route 1. And the zone, by the time I was old enough to go to the zone by myself, I didn't want to go. Because it was just one, you know, desolate, empty storefront with a couple of crackheads hanging out in front of it after another. It became a very dangerous and unappetizing place.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, the combat zone, it was really a wild, fascinating hangout. Women would go there and you know, have a few drinks. They go with their boyfriends. The Harvard football team would go there to celebrate a victory, you know. And that eventually stopped when one of the college football players was stabbed in the street by a pimp after an altercation with a prostitute. That was a whole big Boston story too. A kid named Popolo was celebrating with his teammates and claimed that a prostitute had picked his pocket. Mm. And this created a whole incident where Popolo was stabbed to death by a pimp who actually, going back to my story, had been an ex-boxer.
Mm.
So it all comes around. It all comes around.
What year did that happen?
That was in the late 70s, I think. And that sort of started the zone going in a different direction. because heaven forbid a white football player from Harvard get stabbed in the zone. You know, that created a wave of anxiety, and suddenly the cops started patrolling the combat zone and sort of pushing the prostitutes into different parts of the city. I think a lot of them ended up in Kenmore Square near Fenway Park so they could get the Red Sox audience. They just changed location, but didn't necessarily change their occupation.
Right. I wanted to ask you about this. Do you still think that this kind of phenomenon is going on today, where there's kind of this meeting between boxers and criminals, or maybe it's happening in another sport? Or do you know, what do you think about that?
Well, I alluded to this a little bit in the book. And if I had been able to write a much longer book, I probably could have found modern examples of, say, the Russian mob, right? Mm-hmm. The Russian mob, the Brazilian mob. I'm sure they have, you know, hired some boxers. If not boxers, maybe kickboxers or sort of mixed martial art types, you know. I'm sure years from now, we're going to hear those stories. And it may not be in Boston. It may be in New York or Los Angeles. We'll hear about a different ethnicity, maybe. Maybe Russians, maybe Brazilians, maybe Vietnamese. We'll hear about a different ethnic group and their criminals getting involved with, if not boxers, some sort of tough guys who fight for a living.
I wanted to last question. I wanted to ask you about your other book that you have that you had published through mm-hmm. Hamilcar called Berserk. Will you just talk about that story a little bit?
Sure, I'd love to. Berserk is a book about a Venezuelan boxer named Edwin Valero. And Edwin was an up-and-coming fighter. The boxing world was very excited about this guy. And he was, you know, looked like he was going to be the next big thing. There was talk that he might fight Manny Pacquiao or Floyd Mayweather. People were looking into the future, and they saw this guy, Edwin Valerio. He was the name, you know, he was the man to watch. But he had a lot of problems in his career, and he got very involved in cocaine, alcohol. He was also very abusive to his wife, and one dark day, he showed up in a hotel lobby and told the staff, you know, I just murdered my wife. She's upstairs in our room with her throat cut. And then he sat down and had a cup of coffee. Mm. It was a strange story. When he was arrested, he was taken to a jail in Venezuela. And I believe it was that night. I can't remember if it was one night or two nights. He was found hanging in his cell. So murder-suicide. It was one of the darker days for boxing fans in recent history. This all happened around 10 years ago. And his story, I always thought it was really sad and tragic and horrifying. And Hamilcar wanted to put out a series of books about boxing's dark side. And his name was mentioned. And I said, I'll do that one. I think I could write something about that. And what I found in the writing was that there were really two versions of the story. There's the American version told by American boxing writers who only knew Valero for a short time while he was in Los Angeles. And the American version dismisses him very quickly as just a sort of a drug addicted monster, and let's forget about him as quick as we can, you know. But in Venezuela, he was a hero. He was sort of the Kobe Bryant, the Muhammad Ali. He was a giant figure in Venezuela. So they don't dismiss it the way Americans do. They think of it as just a big tragic story. So my mission in writing that book was to tell both the American version and the Venezuelan version. And I don't think American readers knew the Venezuelan version. So that was sort of my goal in writing that one, was to tell as much of the whole story as possible, because American readers didn't know it. They only knew, you know, he was a drug addict and a monster and he killed his wife. Let's forget him. I wanted to go a little deeper and see what I could turn up.
I have one more last question. What do you think of the state, like the overall state of boxing today? What are your thoughts about it?
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag. There was a fight a few weeks ago in England, or not England, in Las Vegas, between an English fighter, Tyson Fury, mm-hmm. and an American fighter, Deontay Wilder. And that fight was promoted in such a way that it became almost a world event, you know, just huge, huge, huge publicity and big numbers watching on pay-per-view. And it was a big moneymaker. So I think in some regards, boxing is still in pretty good shape. It, once in a while, it can still make huge money. And on the downside, it's only sort of the top maybe 5% of boxers who are making all that money. And there is still the vast majority of boxers are not making that kind of money. So, you know, basically if, say, I don't know if you're a serious, boxing fan or just casual or not at all. But if you heard about the Tyson Fury Deontay Wilder fight, chances are there were 100 other fights going on that week that you didn't hear about.
Yeah. You know?
So it's, in a way, boxing has always been that way. The rich get richer and the poor kind of vanish. Maybe there's something symbolic in that. I don't know. But the difference in boxing now from when I was a younger guy first getting into it is that it's more international. There are more fighters that we're hearing about from other parts of the world. It's not just dominated by Americans. And that's really interesting. You know, in England, a big boxing event can fill up a football stadium. You know, mm-hmm. it's fascinating that the Brits, the Germans, they love boxing in a way that America no longer does. And same thing in Japan. Different parts of the world love boxing. So that's kind of where boxing is now. It may no longer be such a top sport in America, but worldwide, it may be bigger than ever. Did you read the books?
Yeah.
And you, what are your thoughts? Did you like them? Or did you?
I haven't read Berserk. I've only read Slaughter in the Streets. I love this anything related to Boston and crime and stuff like that. My dad's from Watertown, Massachusetts.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
And so I just always liked kind of any kind of history from that area, and I also just really like true crime stuff anyway. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't. I had heard the Barboza, like, the name before, but I didn't realize that he... I just didn't realize his whole story and that he was actually killed out in California.
Yeah, he was a character. There have been a couple of books about Barboza, and I'm never completely satisfied, because when you get into these guys, they told so many lies, mm-hmm. that... even when someone is telling their story, you start wondering, well, you know, where is this information coming from? And they would confess to murders that other guys had done, and they wouldn't confess to their own. I never quite understood that.
Yeah.
And Barboza is one of those guys, definitely a dangerous man with a lot of lies. To get to his story is a challenge.
Yeah. Now, do you live in Boston now, or have you moved away?
I live north of Boston now. I live up on an area called Cape Ann.
Okay.
South of Boston, you have Cape Cod, and north of Boston, you have Cape Ann.
Oh. Okay.
But I lived in Boston and nearby for quite a few years, so I used to feel pretty close to the city. Felt that I understood what was going on, you know. Felt that I knew all the politics, and you know, I'd read the Boston Herald every morning. I really felt like I was part of the scene. But it doesn't take long to lose that feeling if you move away from it. It's so funny now. You know, I just remember. You'd wake up in the morning, you'd get your morning coffee and your local Boston newspaper, and you kind of felt like you knew the pulse of the city. But yeah, I no longer feel that way. I feel very removed from it, and the problems that the city has now, I can't really relate to. But the one consistent thing is that the trains never work. That has never changed.